Today's episode is brought to you by Freetrade, the commission-free investment platform. Welcome to Many Happy Returns, where we aim to make you a better investor. I'm Roman.
And I'm Michael.
With valuations stretched, American stocks need to deliver the goods this earnings season. Companies must grow their profits and defend their margins, or risk the end of the S&P 500 bull market.
I want to know if the numbers justify the high price of US stocks. And in today's dumb question of the week, what is a blackout period? All right, let's get into it. So I think it's fair to say that for quite a while now, a lot of people have been looking at the US market and going, seems kind of expensive. And what was interesting was that this weekend, Berkshire Hathaway, that's Warren Buffett's company, released their quarterly numbers. And interestingly, Buffett's been selling down quite a lot of stock, including 13% of his Apple holdings, which is, you know, their biggest position. And he was kind of blunt about it, saying, you know, we really don't mind holding cash right now.
And I guess part of the reason behind that is that cash is just generating higher returns now. And so equity's really got to push above that envelope of cash returns in order to justify its place in your portfolio.
Yeah, because if cash is getting, well, more than 5%, if you're investing it in short-term treasuries, and remember, that's risk-free, effectively, then stocks with their risk component, you know, you have to really believe that you're going to see good returns over the next year if you're an active manager going in and out of positions all the time.
Maybe it's also because this is the transition year. This is when he's going to hand over the reins to someone else. Maybe they don't want to take too much risk when that's currently happening. So perhaps de-risking is part of that transition.
He actually said that under current conditions, I don't mind building the cash position at all. I think when I look at the alternative of what's available, i.e. the equity markets, and I look at the composition of what's going on in the world, we find cash quite attractive. But then stocks are still doing pretty well, and earnings season has been above expectations.
But I guess the time at which you want to sell is when things are pretty good, if you think there's going to be a deterioration, or perhaps you just think that things are overvalued now.
The other point he made actually was around taxes, and they're paying an effective tax rate of 21%. And he has a feeling that taxes are going to go up in the future because of the fiscal deficit in the US. So maybe now's not a bad time to take some profits, according to Warren Buffett. But overall, Berkshire posted really good earnings. And now we've seen 80% of companies in the S&P 500 reporting their results for the first quarter. And overall, I'd say they've been pretty good, haven't they, Roman?
Yeah, overall, it's been a good quarter, I think. You know, the average growth rate for earnings since the Second World War, the real earnings growth rate's been about 6% nominal. It's roughly the return on the S&P 500, 9%-ish. And so far for this season, for Q1 2024, the average earnings, if you kind of munge it over the ones which have reported and the ones which haven't, this is usually called the blended earnings growth rate. It's about 5%. So that's not terrible. It's not great. And it's pretty good.
It's better than it was forecast to be at the end of the last quarter, where they thought it'd be more like 3%.
Yeah, we're kind of coming out of a period when analysts previously expected a fairly weak earnings growth, and it's kind of surprised slightly on the upside. But I think at the moment, the problem is, as you said in the opening, that valuations in the US are high, expectations are extremely high, and we're still relying on fairly brisk earnings growth to justify that and to keep it high.
Certainly the current earnings growth is below the recent average. So the five-year growth rate is 9%. And the 10-year growth rate is 8.3%. So, you know, we're at 5 at the moment. It's decent, but maybe it's not enough to justify where prices are.
And below that long-term average. So I think it is looking not catastrophic, but in order to justify very high valuations, I think it's got to be higher than it is. So perhaps this is going to be the cause of some weakness in the next few months, in the next few quarters, unless earnings growth does pick up.
I mean, the boil does seem to have come off the S&P 500 over the last 3 months. It's roughly flat, isn't it, since February?
Yeah, year by year, we've been flipping between risk-on and risk-off years. 2022 was a tech wreck, 23 was the recovery. And then 2024 started off as something that looked like 2023 redux. But of course, what actually happened is that we kind of fizzled out about a third of the way through the year.
The way that markets seem to be reacting to companies when they report their earnings is that if a company beats the market expectation, they're barely rewarded for it. So they're getting less than a 1% stock bump on average. Whereas if they miss their revenue and sales estimates, they're getting quite heavily punished, down by more than 5% on average, compared to a 3% drop being the 5-year average for missing your earnings.
I always think of this kind of beats and misses thing is a little bit of a dog and pony show, because, you know, how it works is the company gives forward guidance, right? So they say, look, this is what we think we're going to get next quarter and the quarter after that. We think things are looking good. This is what we're expecting. And then surprise, surprise, they beat their own estimate. So, you know, it's not hardly surprising. It's like saying to your parents, look, my exam results next year are going to be terrible. And then surprise, surprise, you beat them. So
yeah, I mean, that's one way it works. But isn't it also like the broker forecasts, who are in theory independent and are coming up with what they think a company is going to do in the next quarter, next year?
Independent, yes.
And then you aggregate them all, and then the company either does better than expectations or worse than expectations. Now, I don't know how those brokers put those forecasts together.
Yeah, I think it is influenced by the guidance from the companies themselves. I mean, obviously, they'll try and come up with their own estimate, but that's certainly going to be influenced by what they hear from the corporate management of the company itself, because they have access to that.
But by no means do all companies issue formal guidance for sales and for profits.
Yeah, and usually when you hear about it, it's not good news. You know, they say, oh, we're not going to have such great results next quarter because of X, Y, and Z.
I mean, you say it's all a bit of a dog and pony show and a bit meaningless, but the market does seem to react differently to whether you beat or miss your targets. Not always in a predictable way. So I saw that Tesla missed expectations but rallied more than 10%, and Meta beat expectations but dropped more than 10%. So there it was the inverse of what should happen, but generally companies are rewarded for outperforming market expectations.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that a lot of it's factored in. You know, that's what people often say. If you can't explain it, you say, oh, it was factored in. Yeah, but this beats and misses thing, I'm not convinced it's a helpful way of looking at things. But look, earnings certainly matter, and it's always relative to expectations. So yeah, maybe it is worth considering what those expectations are.
So what's a better way of looking at it then? Because you talk about the forward price to earnings ratio all the time, and that uses expectations of the market.
Yeah, what it does is it looks at the broker aggregated forecasts, and it kind of aggregates it up for the index as a whole. You know, if you average lots of random numbers, you come up with an average of random numbers. And it is kind of factoring in everything we know about a given company. So the brokers presumably are usually skewed to the upside. They're usually quite optimistic for reasons of conflicts of interest. That's kind of assumed. And so usually it's a kind of conservative estimate, because brokers are optimistic. That pushes up the earnings forecast. So the price-to-earnings multiple makes it look a little bit cheaper if you look at the forward price-to-earnings multiple. But that's why I look at the forward price-to-earnings multiple, because I think it's a better indicator of how stocks are priced. You know, they're forward-looking.
And how is that looking now then for the S&P 500, given the current quarter's results?
Well, I mean, it's not egregiously high. So we're looking at a price-to-earnings multiple, a forward price-to-earnings multiple currently of about 20 times forward earnings. And the PE ratio is above the 5-year average. It's above the 10-year average. The 5-year average is 19.1. The 10-year average is about 17.8. But if we compare it to something like 2020, the end of 2020 and the beginning of 2021, when it was a 23 times multiple, it's looking more reasonable, but it is getting toppy.
Yeah, it has been coming down this year, as we said. So since the end of last quarter, the S&P 500 has actually fallen around 3.5%, while the 12-month earning forecasts that go into the PE ratio have actually increased by 1.5%. So they're both moving in opposite directions, which kind of makes it look a bit cheaper.
And this is what happens. You know, if markets get ahead of profits, then there's some kind of catch-up period often where stocks trade sideways and then earnings carry on grinding upwards. So the multiple starts to fall slightly, which is just healthy, I think. You know, I think that's just a reasonable way for things to happen. It's much better than a really rapid correction when suddenly people realize, oh my goodness, we've overpaid for this.
Where's the money?
What have I done?
And if you look at 2024 as a calendar year, so the whole year, the earnings forecasts are for a growth of 11%, which would be really good. That would be above the historic average if they can deliver it. But if you look at the breakdown by quarter, analysts are forecasting a lot of that earnings growth to come in the fourth quarter. It seems to keep getting pushed back and back quarter by quarter. It's like the big, big growth is coming, we hope.
I guess one of the problems, if you're an analyst at the moment, is we're going to span an election in the US, and it's really uncertain who's going to be holding the reins. And I'm not convinced I could forecast what will happen to profits given who's going to be in the White House. I don't think it's clear-cut at all. If we were to switch to a Trump presidency, then I think we'll move back towards more fossil fuel subsidies, perhaps. But really, I think both of the presidents are quite keen to get growth going again and will be friendly for the US stock market. That's always true of US politics, quite in contrast with the UK, for example.
I mean, I don't know what's going to happen politically, but the thing that catches my attention is that analysts are forecasting revenues to grow this calendar year by 4.9%. And as we've already said, they're forecasting profits to grow by 11%. So I guess that's possible, but it would imply that margins, which are already really high, would presumably have to expand further to grow earnings faster than revenues.
Yeah, so the current margin, this is the percentage of turnover that makes it through the costs to profit. That's currently 11.7%, and that's pretty high by historic standards. Certainly not a record, but pretty high. If you look at the median since 1956, somewhere around there, it would be around 8.5%. So that's pretty high compared to history.
But margins have been high for a while, I guess. The five-year average is 11.5%, so it's roughly in line with that. But the thing is, can they expand further from these very high levels?
I think one problem is that you've got a higher cost of servicing your debt. So for indebted companies, it's going to be really hard to grow margins, given that that debt servicing cost is going to be a drag on profits. Maybe we'll get a boost from a change in presidency. I don't know if Trump could manage to do another corporate tax cut. Probably not.
And we've got inflation ticking up again, which obviously affects the input costs for a lot of companies.
Which is not good news, right? So I think it's going to be tricky. It's going to be an uphill battle to try and get margins higher. Or you could cut costs via staff. And again, I think that's going to be difficult, because if there is high demand and the economy is still looking pretty good, you're not going to want to cut your staff in that kind of environment.
And I guess the other consideration on margin is that a lot of the big companies in the index, here I'm thinking about the tech companies, Microsoft, Alphabet, Meta, those kind of stocks, they're all planning a lot of CapEx spending. So they're going to be investing in infrastructure. I think a lot of this is going into AI. So if you take Microsoft, for example, and you look at their spending on CapEx in 23, that was around 30 billion, give or take. This year, it's forecast to be over 50 billion. And in 2025, more like 70 billion. So that's a lot of money that's going to presumably be cutting into their margins.
Another reason, I think, for why margins are going to be difficult to improve from here. And if you're not familiar with margins, if you look across different sectors, there's a vast difference between sectors. For example, IT typically has very high margins, 20, 25%. That's not unusual. Whereas if you look at something like consumer staples, that operates on very tight margins. So if you're thinking about a supermarket, for example, they don't have big margins, they just have big volume.
And the differential is stark this quarter specifically. So IT's increased its margin as a sector in the US from 22.4% to 25.6%. And like you say, at the bottom of the table, consumer staples, just 6.1%.
Yeah, I mean, for a supermarket, my default setting is 5%. I always think, okay, that's kind of normal. Now, I think there may be a setup here for a problem in the quarters and years ahead for the S&P 500, which is it's very concentrated in stocks which have been pushed up by this AI narrative. And if these companies have overinvested in AI, then the risk is that it's not going to pay off. And that's going to hurt their bottom line, given the amount of expenditure in that kind of AI space.
I guess the risk long term is that AI becomes a commodified market. And it's just a consumer doesn't care who's giving them access to the language models or whatever it might be, just whoever can give it to me cheaply, if they're all as good as one another. I mean, we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, the thing is, I'm getting it from multiple different companies. So, for example, Zoom's telling me they've got AI built in. I've got a separate subscription to an AI type app, which is Bairdly, which sits on top of OpenAI and various other large language models.
I'm a kind of AI that helps you out sometimes.
Indeed. Very powerful one, it's got to be said. But then at the same time, Google, I've got a professional subscription to Google for the company. They're saying, do you want to pay extra for our AI tools? And I'm thinking, well, no, not really.
No, Google, your model is freemium. I am not going to be part of that Eon bit. Just the free, thanks.
I think that's the problem. If you've got multiple companies offering you the same thing, why would you choose one over another? Why would you choose five different AI services rather than just one?
It's a question, isn't it? Are they going to compete on quality or are they going to compete on price? We don't know the answer to that yet. How AI models are going to turn out? What are people going to use them for? Hence, everyone's looking at NVIDIA, which is the picks and shovels play, as everyone keeps saying, sell the chips and then it doesn't matter who wins the AI race. And interestingly, I saw on Bloomberg that the market is pricing in as much risk around the NVIDIA earnings report towards the end of this month as it is for the non-farm payrolls report. Like if you look at the options market, that is seen as big a risk as payrolls, which is kind of extraordinary. One company has that impact on the S&P 500.
The S&P 500 has become the S&P 1, unfortunately.
In terms of volatility, it seems like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of hope hanging on NVIDIA at the moment, isn't there? And the interesting thing about NVIDIA is that it's got such a large contribution to total earnings growth for the IT sector for the US. And if you exclude NVIDIA from the blended year-on-year earnings growth rate for IT, the sector's growth rate would fall to 10.4% from 23.2%. So it would halve the earnings growth rate for IT year-on-year.
Yeah, like we say, they haven't reported yet. And that's why the options market is saying this date is important, obviously. It was last quarter as well, and NVIDIA actually smashed their earnings expectations, and they were already lofty expectations. Can they keep doing it? We'll see.
No.
Oh, big call. No. You're bearish.
Well, look, eventually it's going to calm down. It's got to. You can't keep on growing at that rate.
But didn't we just talk about the CapEx spending of Microsoft and Meta and what have you? That's going to NVIDIA.
But look, you can only do that a certain number of quarters, and they're developing their own chips anyway. So they're trying to move away from being dependent on NVIDIA.
But they're partnering with NVIDIA to do that most of the time.
Yeah. But look, they're not going to be dependent on NVIDIA forever. There'll be competitors from elsewhere.
We need to get Laura on here to give us the bull case.
That's right. Laura's Waters. She certainly knows her stuff. She's already bagged her 100% profit on NVIDIA, and she's still got exposure to it.
We've all got exposure to it, more than we might be comfortable with based on market cap.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Free Trade. Free Trade is offering a free share worth between £10 and £100, exclusively for Many Happy Returns listeners. Simply download the app, fund your account with at least £50, and get a free share today. Ready to claim your free share? Head over to freetrade.io/pensioncraft today. You can also find the link in the show notes. Free Trade is an award-winning investment app with over 1.5 million UK registered users. You can invest commission-free in over 6,200 UK, US and European stocks and ETFs. Looking for more than simply commission-free investing, Free Trade offers tax-efficient investing through a stocks and shares ISA and a self-invested personal pension. Join over 1.5 million UK registered users on Free Trade and claim your free share today. Capital at risk, other charges apply, ISA and SIP eligibility and tax rules apply. The probability is weighted, so more expensive shares will be rarer. Terms and conditions apply.
I mean, here we've kind of been talking about earnings season in a bubble, but obviously it doesn't exist in a bubble. Stocks are extremely sensitive to what's going on in the wider economy. And things seem to be changing there. Like we said, inflation in the US has been ticking up a little bit. The Fed's kind of backed off imminent rate cuts, and this higher for longer narrative is back. That's surely not great news for stocks.
I think you have to take these things in perspective, and a good way to get perspective is to read the economic reports from the Federal Reserve, which provide a great overview of the state of the US economy. And the overall picture is one of still pretty strong demand, and employment is still looking quite strong, although I'll come back to that. Interest rates are expected to stay higher for longer now. That's the common expectation, like you said. But I'd say the direction of travel for inflation is downwards overall, and I think that's likely to continue. What is worrying is if you look at the unemployment rate in the US, it is ticking up. So this whole thing about immaculate disinflation, getting inflation down without a recession, without a big pickup in unemployment, I think that narrative may start to unwind. Because if you're familiar with the SARM rule, this is Claudia Sarm's real-time indicator of whether we're in a recession in the US. The way that works is to look at that rate of growth of unemployment. And it's just an almost infallible measure of when the US enters recession. It's when an unemployment ticks up. And it is ticking up. It's really not that far from the kind of threshold, which would mean the US was in recession. Not a deep one. And it really depends on whether this momentum carries on increasing.
We're not seeing that in the GDP numbers yet. The rate of growth of economic activity is down, but it's still positive.
Yeah, and this was one of the questions in the press conference following the FOMC's announcement last week. And somebody said, is there any sign of stagflation? And Jerome Powell gave a fairly lengthy answer, but then he kind of summed it up. He said, I don't see the stag and I don't see the inflation. And I think that's true. I think, you know, inflation's coming down and the growth is looking okay, but not great.
The interesting thing about earnings season is that maybe some of these companies are quite well positioned to see whether there's a bit of stagflation coming. It was interesting that a lot of the fast food restaurants, who are obviously targeted at lower end consumers a lot of the time, and they see a lot of the American economy pass through their doors, they're getting increasingly worried, I think, about consumers cutting back on spending. So this is coming from people like McDonald's, Burger King. Interestingly, Starbucks had a terrible quarter. Their same store sales in the US fell by 3%, and they saw a 6% decline in foot traffic when it was expected to be flat. They were punished for it. Their stock fell more than 15% the next day following the earnings announcement. But do you take anything from this? These kind of CEOs warning that all is not well in the US economy?
Yeah, and I think if you understand where the revenue is coming from, that's really important. So, for example, if you look at the revenue exposure by geography, information technology is the most international one. And the US market as a whole is surprisingly domestically driven. So 59% of the revenue comes from within the United States. Whereas for IT, that's only just over 40%. So what I'd be looking at would be those domestically driven sectors, primarily financials, industrials, consumer discretionary.
I guess that depends if you think, yeah, America might be slowing down, but it's probably still in a better position than most other economies.
Yeah, I love the description of the least dirty shirt. I think that's a good way of describing where the US sits at the moment. It's not amazing, but in terms of getting inflation down, in terms of keeping growth while it does so, it is looking pretty good.
Yeah, I'm not all that bearish on the American economy. It's just interesting when you see people who are on the front line saying that, yeah, the consumer is not looking as healthy as it was a year ago. But then maybe Starbucks is just making excuses and saying, we've had a bad quarter, our coffee's crap. But no, it's not the coffee, it's the people haven't got money to spend.
You know, I don't even drink coffee and I can taste that the Starbucks coffee is dreadful.
You know what made me laugh was that they said, we want to introduce a zero-calorie energy drink. And I thought, that's just black coffee. This should be what you're selling to everyone.
It's just caffeine, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, to get a sense of the overall American economy, I come back to where we started, which is Berkshire Hathaway. They touch a lot of sectors, don't they, in their earnings? They obviously own railways, they own insurance companies, they own energy companies, and they own a broad selection of stocks as well, like American Express, Coca-Cola, Apple, obviously. So in a way, they're Warren Buffett's mini index fund of the American economy. And they've had a good quarter, and Warren Buffett sounded relatively optimistic, albeit while hoarding cash. So do you believe his words, or do you believe his big cash pile, his $189 billion of treasuries?
I think you've got to understand that it's an insurance company, so they've got to keep a big cash pile on hand. You know, they don't really have a choice about that. It's only very special occasions when they dip into that and start to buy lots of companies.
Yeah, but there's a range they can hold it in. They could hold 100 billion or they could hold 200 billion. They're at the top end of that range.
But clearly, at the moment, they're just not seeing those incredible deals. I think the name that they give to the section which does whole company acquisitions is big game hunting. That's what they call it.
Really? I didn't know that.
So I think that's a great description. But at the moment, the game's just not there, or at least it's too expensive. It's just not worth chasing.
What I thought was interesting was that one of the audience asked Buffett, why don't you look more overseas? You're still so focused on American stocks. And he said, yeah, it's going to stay that way because I know America best. And to be honest, he doesn't really believe in the economic growth story of the rest of the world, seemed to be the undertone of what he was saying. Yes, he's gone and invested in these Japanese conglomerates, but he said that was a really special case and it was just too good to be true, the deal basically. But he said, if we're going to do something big, it's going to be in the US or maybe Canada.
But he's always had that bias. He's always been very much US focused. He's always said, you know, buy the S&P 500, don't bet against America. So that's part of the narrative that's been going on for some time from Warren Buffett, for his entire career, I'd say.
I think he believes it, though. Like, I reckon if he felt he could make more money overseas, he would. He's very much focused on the bottom line.
And he's dipped his toe. He's bought stuff in China. He's bought stuff in Japan in the past.
But do you not think it's interesting that we've said that there are markets around the world which look cheap? Maybe it's a mirage and they're cheap for a reason, but, you know, the UK, for one, is not looking particularly expensive. Why doesn't Warren Buffett come and buy some of our companies? He's got the money.
Why don't we have our own Warren Buffett? I think that'd be much better. You know, someone who'd be UK-based, but which would also be able to buy UK companies. Unfortunately, the ones that we have usually migrate to Mauritius.
Monaco.
Or Monaco.
Yeah, that's the thing about Buffett. He's lived in Omaha his whole life. I think he still lives out of the same five-bed house he bought in the 60s. You know, he's quite modest for a billionaire, really, isn't he?
Yeah, I saw someone take their picture outside his house, and I just thought that must be awful, you know, if you've just got people rocking up outside your house trying to take pictures of themselves.
I thought you meant his house was awful. I can't imagine living there if you had all the money in the world. All right, so from everything we've talked about here, it seems like the current quarter for US stocks, it's kind of okay. But more importantly, analysts are forecasting that earnings are going to grow really strongly for the rest of the year. And stock markets don't seem to have reacted massively up or down as a result of this quarter's earnings. So what's your feeling on this then? Are US stocks kind of fairly priced where they are at a 20 times forward price to earnings multiple? It's definitely higher than the rest of the world, but is that justifiable?
What's interesting is that valuations in the US have been creeping upwards for about a decade now, and that's a pretty clear trend. And some people think this is just the new normal because there is no fixed valuation, which is the fundamental value that it should always revert to. It could be that it creeps up over time. So I think compared to recent history, even then, it's looking reasonably expensive. So I think it is overpriced. I think there's no question it's overpriced in the US right now. Would I do anything about it? Well, as many people know, the answer is no, I wouldn't. I'd just carry on buying a global index. And, you know, 60% of that's going to be US.
Is there a level it could get to where you would do something about it and diverge from your plan of just one fund market cap weighted around the world?
I don't think so, because it is self-correcting. And I think it can stay elevated for a long period of time. And I can't really confidently call when the market's going to turn. So I think that kind of timing argument, which is, okay, at this level of valuation for the US, I'm going to sell and then I'll buy back in when it reaches a 17 times multiple. I just don't think that would work for me. Plus, it would be too scary and stressful.
You must be tempted, though. Everyone's tempted when you look at it and you go, oh, this is way more expensive than the rest of the world and it's 60% of my fund.
Well, I'll take a leaf out of Warren's book. And when someone asked him, should I buy an equal weighted S&P 500 tracker? He just waffled about wills. But his general point was that you really shouldn't worry too much about beating the S&P 500. You should really try and have an excess of savings such that whether you outperform by 1, 2, 3% doesn't really matter. And I think that's right. I think, you know, you should just chill and not worry too much about trying to avoid catastrophe or gain an extra 1% long term. Just not worth it.
But at the same time, I wouldn't put all my eggs in the S&P 500 basket right now.
Oh, I never would, no. Now, we've been talking a lot about valuation for the US stock market today, and that's part of our trackers in PensionCraft, which you get access to as one of our members. Plus, you get to discuss the results with other people and how to react to it. If you want to learn more about joining our membership, just go to pensioncraft.com.
Okay, today's dumb question of the week is, what is a blackout period?
Now, really, this is all about insider trading. What is insider trading? It's when material, non-public information that could affect the company's stock price leaks to the market. Now, the idea here is that you can release market-moving information, but you have to release it to the entire market all in one go. So nobody has an informational advantage. So if you do leak that information, it's illegal. And if it's material, which means it moves markets, and you tell someone about it, doesn't matter who it is, if it's your partner, if it's someone that you play squash with, all of these would be considered a crime.
I don't know why you always think squash courts are sort of the hub of illegal trading activity. You mentioned that before.
I'll tell you why. Because we had compliance training at the bank I used to work at, and that was the example they used.
And you just internalized it.
Well, I just had to do that training every quarter, I think. You know, so it was just drummed into me.
So the point with insider trading, obviously, is there is this information which should be private. And if you trade on it, or if you allow someone else to trade on it and, you know, buy or sell a stock because you know something's coming down the pipe, yeah, prison is the way you'll go. So what's the blackout period then?
Well, I mean, I guess what you could do is you could just look at the behavior of one of the company's employees, particularly senior management. And if you see them buying up, you know, lots of stock in their own company, well, you might have an inkling that something's coming down the pipeline in terms of information. So what you don't want to do is to let that information leak out through behavior. So there are certain periods when staff can't do certain things, like buy or sell stock. And this is called a blackout period.
But people do look at what a CEO is buying or selling in their own company and other senior staff all the time. But is a blackout period basically saying there are some parts of the year which are so sensitive, like around quarterly earnings is the big example, where we're going to stop our executives trading for a couple of weeks beforehand until the market has seen the results?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So these sensitive periods would be just before an earnings release. And I don't think it's mandatory for a company to do this, but it must just be considered good corporate behavior to impose these blackout periods.
Yeah, I think they're worried about risk, aren't they? It's not even that their staff might, you know, okay, our sales are way down, so I'm going to sell the stock, because that's really obvious and you'd think they'd get into trouble with the regulators. But it's not just about avoiding actual wrongdoing and insider trading. I think it's also around avoiding the perception of insider trading. Because you can imagine, you know, a CEO sold his stock because he wanted to buy a new house, and it just happened to be before an earnings release, which went horribly wrong. Everyone will go, hang on, that CEO just stole all his stock. So they want to stop that happening, even if it wasn't for nefarious reasons.
And frankly, directors are usually very bad at working out how the earnings are going to affect the company. And they don't trade particularly well. It's something I looked at years back, and they're just not very good at it. So in fact, it turned out, I think, that if you did the opposite of what the director did, you do fairly well.
What, as in you see a lot of insider selling and you buy, and that's a good signal to do that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they're not particularly informative, these directors' deals. Although people often report on them. For example, if a company's running into trouble, sometimes just to signal that everything's okay, the senior management will start buying stock.
So that's the last time you want to buy if it's running into trouble.
That's probably why it's a contrarian signal.
All right, yeah. Just add it to the list of things we should ignore then in markets. So like every podcast, we add stuff to this list of don't trade based on that, don't trade based on that.
Yeah, well, the people are always looking for some kind of silver bullet, but there isn't one. I think that's why the list is going to grow ever longer.
And it's why your one fund just keeps on ticking.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Thank you for joining us for Many Happy Returns. Do send us your questions, no matter how dumb, at the email address mhr@pensioncraft.com.
And do remember to check out pensioncraft.com for all the information about our membership and investment coaching options.
Many Happy Returns is a Pensioncraft production, co-hosted and executive produced by Romy Nakiza and Michael Pugh. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes and is not financial advice. We do not provide recommendations or endorse any decision to buy, sell, or hold any security. We cannot be held responsible for any actions listeners may take, and investors are encouraged to seek independent financial advice.